It is advice and life lessons for the next generation that stand the test of time. Stories passed down to a young grandson. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's meditations on family, race, creativity, being a good listener. The new book is called Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life. Are you a grandparent with wisdom to share? What anecdotes or stories do you want to share with your grandchildren? Did an elder impart knowledge to you that you will never, ever forget? Share this wisdom, 800-642-1234. Charles Johnson is a National Book Award winner, a MacArthur Genius Fellow. He's a philosopher, professor, and most important on this list, he is a grandfather to an 8-year-old boy. His new book is called Grand. Charles, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Your stories and your life lessons seem all the more salient now that our world and our communities are in so much pain. What can you tell us at this moment?
What can I tell you? I guess I can tell you that I'm in pain as well with all of the suffering that's going on globally, actually, and in our own country. One of the things I think maybe about the new book, Grand, that might be of interest to people is the advice that I give to my grandson about change and impermanence and letting things go when it's necessary to let things go.
When is it necessary to let things go? What have you learned?
What have I learned? Well, what I've learned is that if there is one law, I suppose, in our life, that law is change. And change is inevitable, right? Everything will die at some point so that something else can be born. I think that's the kind of natural rhythm that we find in nature. So things have their life expectancy, you know, institutions, countries, human lives, plants, you know, everything. Even the universe has its own, you know, ending at one point. We won't see it. It's quite a long way off. But yes, impermanence and change are something that I meditate on quite a bit because I'm a practicing Buddhist and I think about it every day.
Yeah, when you received your MacArthur Genius Grant in 98, your present to yourself, as you put it, was to study Sanskrit. Why did you do that?
Why did I say, why? Well, I wanted to give myself a present. Now, I also supported other things, you know, in terms of donations. And my daughter and at the time had a business here in Seattle that she was running. And, you know, I supported her with parts of the MacArthur. But the reason for Sanskrit is because I'd been fascinated since my teens by that language, which is extraordinarily beautiful. And so much of what is written in my particular religion, Buddhism, is in either Pali or it's in Sanskrit. It's an incredibly unambiguous language. It's, you know, the sentences are like equations. So I have to bring everything to it when I study Sanskrit, you know, mind and spirit, both.
Yeah. When you bring your mind and your spirit to it, what changes inside of you? What happens?
What happens? What happens is I feel a certain kind of clarity and peace and centeredness. That's exactly what I feel.
Tell us about your grandson, Emery, for whom you wrote this book to.
Well, right now he's sleeping.
Good for him.
it's 4:10 in the morning here.
In Seattle, yes. So thank you for getting up so early for us.
Oh, I didn't go to bed. I usually work until 5 or 6 in the morning because those are the hours when my family is sleeping. And also, for 33 years, I had my day job at the University of Washington as a professor. So these are the quiet hours, you know, from midnight, rather, till about 5 or 6 that I could work. What about Emery? Well, he is 8 years old. He is, like most children, 8 years old, beautiful and brilliant and sees things with fresh eyes. And that's what I think I enjoy the most, seeing the world from a fresh perspective through his eyes, because he's only got 8 years of experience. You know, he doesn't have any biases or prejudices or anything like that. And everything for a child involves wonder, you know, mystery and wonder. And they have a hunger to learn and to grow. And there's so many areas in which they can grow, you know, in mind, body, and spirit. Over the next, you know, 10 years, you know, until he's 18 years old, and beyond that. So one of the things I really do suggest to my grandson and his generation in the 10 points that I make in the new book, Grand, is that they should be lifelong learners. You know, this is what I would hope that they would be.
And you've been a lifelong learner as well.
Yes, I have. I think learning, I think knowledge is delicious. Let me put it that way. Knowledge, learning something new is delicious. And also, it's humbling in the sense that I've come to learn that all of our knowledge is, in one way or another, partial. It's provisional, right? It's provisional because if we get new knowledge, new information, we have to change what we think, you know, and what we believe. And so much of what we experience, you know, is just a little tiny piece of what's out there.
We're talking with philosopher Charles Johnson. He is our guide to life this hour. His new book is called Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life. And you can join in. Are you a grandparent with wisdom to share? What anecdotes or stories do you want to share with your own grandchild? Did one of your grandparents impart wisdom onto you? And what was it? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Charles, you quote the philosopher William James saying that most people live, whether physically, intellectually, or morally, in a very restricted circle of their potential being. How should we reckon with that when we could do so much more?
How should we reckon? this is the question that's really important, I think, for our grandchildren and for ourselves. How do we actualize our full potential?
Yeah.
You know, how do we do that? I think we do that by always challenging ourselves, you know, to learn more and to grow, you know. One of the quotes I have in the book I like a lot is from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "It is our duty to be discontented with the measure we have of knowledge and virtue, to forget the things behind and press toward those before." At every stage of our lives, every season of our lives, I think we have to ask ourselves the question, what is the good life, right? One of the suggestions I have to the very first one in the book to my grandson is know thyself. Know thyself. This is a challenge, right? Because we're going to change as we grow, you know, from childhood to adolescence to young personhood to middle age to old age, you know, to the winter season, which I find myself in. And so we have to, at every stage and season of our lives, ask the question over and over again, what is the good life? Who am I? What can I do that will actualize more and more of my potential?
And on that journey, on that search for finding yourself and for giving everything you can to what your passion is, what if you don't find that passion?
What if you don't find, well, to be, I had the, in my lifetime, 72 years, I had the kind of reverse problem. I found so many things I was passionate about, you know, so many things that I loved and so many things that I wanted to serve. And so for me, the question was always, how do I bring them all together in a single lifetime? Which, you know, if you think about it, we live maybe about 90-ish years, right? If you go back 100 years, say go back to 1920, 1915, the average life expectancy for a male was about 47 years. We have improved, you know, on expanding the human lifespan. So So it, you know, we're somewhere in the 90s, maybe, if we're lucky. So, but still, that's the blink of an eye, right?
Yeah.
That is really a short period of time when you think about the age of the Earth, which is 4.5 billion years old, I think, and the universe is somewhere at maybe, oh, I don't know, 17 billion years old. So 90 years is a lot of time. So how I would say don't waste a single day of your life. Not a single day.
Yeah. Put everything you have into each moment. We're with novelist Charles Johnson, who is with us. His new book is called Grand, and it's a small book of heartfelt lessons passed down to his young grandson. What life lessons have you shared with your grandchildren? How do you lead by example as a grandparent? Are you involved in the care of your grandchildren amid the pandemic? How's it going for you? Share your stories, your advice, 800-642-1234, email ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with author Charles Johnson right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with author and philosopher Charles Johnson here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He passes along advice in his new book called Grand. He writes, I want my grandson's life to circle the sun more times than I've made on my journey so far. If that happens, I imagine that he will be washed by all waters. Have you written a letter to a grandchild telling them about life lessons and what's most important? Do you have a favorite saying that you tell your grandkids? What is it? Join in to talk about it, 800-642-1234. And Charles Johnson stays with us. Charles, you know, it must feel about giving advice a bit of trepidation, because as you write about these perennial truths, you also have quite a bit of reservation about passing along advice. What are those reservations like?
Well, they are several, actually. My first reservation is that grandfatherly advice is as plentiful as blackberries.
I love that line.
yeah, you can find a lot of grandfather or grandmother advice out there. The second trepidation that I have is that I was born, you know, in 1948, just shortly after World War II. So my life experiences in the 50s and the 60s are very different from what my grandson, 8 years old now, is going to experience in his lifetime. We live in a world that's very radically different in many ways from the one that I grew up in. So, you know, I want to temper the advice that I give to him so that it's adaptable for the new circumstances in which he finds himself. You know, for example, at his school, every week the students study coding, and the curriculum is heavy on science as well. And that's important, you know, today. I think maybe by the time he's 17, 18, coding will be a skill that was as necessary for me in the 60s as typing. You know, knowing how to type.
Yeah.
The requirements, you know, for a happy life, it may be slightly different, but I do think there are some perennial, timeless kinds of ideas that are in the book that he might benefit from.
When you talk about creativity, you have a love of jazz. We tried to pick out some jazz music for you this morning in the breaks.
Really?
But, you know, I'm wondering what draws you to jazz and what is there about creativity in life to you?
Well, you know, I'm also a cartoonist and illustrator. So when I'm in the final stages of a drawing, something I love to do is listen to soft jazz. It's very soothing. Oh, and Don't have a saxophone in it, okay? Then I'm just in heaven. but, you know, music, you know, and I have no musical talent, I think my parents wasted money trying to give me piano and clarinet lessons, but all I wanted to do was draw when I was a kid. But creativity is all around us. It's a necessity. And what do I mean by that? I mean that everything that we're going to be facing is going to require not just our intellect, but our imagination, right, for problem solving across the board. You know, one of the things I find interesting is that if you've been around long enough, you realize that in some sense, all of the arts are connected, whether we're talking about the visual arts, or we're talking about music, or we're talking about the art of architecture. There's something common that flows, you know, between all artistic and even intellectual activities, even the sciences. Going back to the 20s, you know, with the discovery of the quantum realm, and, you know, some of the scientists suggested, you know, what we should do is, you young scientists, you should read poetry, you know, and you should read literature. So where do we get the word quark from? It comes from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Murray Gell-Mann, the great scientist, found it, the word quark, you know, for this new subatomic entity that nobody had named before. So in many, many ways, I think we should be very open to learn from many different disciplines.
Let's take a call. Now let's bring in Marcus joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you, Kate?
I'm doing well.
Wonderful. So I would just like to say, first off, there was a quote my grandfather used to say to me a lot, which I think your guests will probably recognize. The quote is, human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives.
Oh.
William James, psychologist and philosopher.
Mm. I like that.
And the other thing is that I feel that good common sense wisdom and, you know, just good moral compass type quotes and things like that just provide people with direction. And even though times may change, skill sets may change, the way to interact and be in this world really doesn't. And that's why these things, these sayings have persisted for so long and will continue to persist, I believe.
Marcus, thank you so much for that. Charles, what could you add there?
Well, I'm delighted that he cited William James, but I'm also delighted that he pointed out the importance of having a moral compass. You know, a great deal of the wisdom that we pass down to our young people involves that kind of wisdom. You know, one of the quotes I have, it's in the beginning of the introduction to Grand. It's from Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 29, 18, where there is no vision, the people perish. I thought about that a lot over the years, where there is no vision, the people perish. I think, you know, we have to give our young people a sense of, you know, moral clarity. So, you know, one of the things I say in the book is, you know, I want my grandson to be mindful of and protect his reputation even before he has a reputation.
Oh, yeah. Charles Johnson is with us. New book is called Grand. It's about the grandfatherly advice and wisdom he hopes to pass along to his 8-year-old grandson, Emery. You can join in with your observations. Are you a grandparent? Have you passed down wisdom? What is it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Charles, you talk about listening more than talking and egoless listening. What is that like?
That's very important. You know, all too often when we're talking to each other, we're not listening. What's going through our mind is the next thing we're going to say, right? Mm-hmm. But not really listening to the other person fully and egolessly. I do think that is the right phrase for it. There's a quote in here by a philosopher, it might be Epictetus, that I like a lot. He says, we have two ears and one mouth so that we can listen twice as much as we talk, right? And when, you know, one of the things I have the hardest time doing sometimes is listening to news talk shows, because the people are just kind of shouting at each other, right? They're not really listening to each other or responding to each other. There's a point that they want to make, and they're kind of twiddling their thumbs, waiting for the other person to be quiet, so they can make their point. That kind of dialogue is not the sort of dialectic that I like. I like to learn from others, and that means getting my own ego out of the way and listening carefully to what they have to say.
Let's bring in Chris now in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hello. What a joy to hear your voice this morning. But when you talked about Emerson, it made me think of something else he said, that the soul's greatest job is to wonder. And the soul's greatest duty is to be of good cheer. I have been a teacher for over 60 years, of all ages, little to old to young, to television to radio. And I grew up on a farm dreaming, going to a one-room school. And that dreaming of better things, of what's good for the least of us is good for the best of us and the rest of us. And we have to think that the world is going to be a better thing. And I just think today we're pushing so much information into children that they don't have time to think and to do critical thinking and think, this isn't the answer, but to dream of better times and do whatever you can to keep this country of ours, the world free, and the environment, so that our great-great-great-grandchildren will have a wonderful world to live in.
And Chris, thank you so much. And we're going to get Charles Johnson to respond to you just in a moment here after the news break. We have Charles Johnson spending the hour. His new book is called Grand. And your thoughts as well. Have you started sharing more with your grandchildren amid the pandemic and now the protests? What are you saying? What are these conversations like? 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more conversation with author Charles Johnson after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with National Book Award winning author Charles Johnson here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. His new book of advice and reflections is one for the ages. He writes, "What we know is always vastly outweighed by what we don't know and may never know, and we really do live our lives in the midst of great mysteries." What is some wisdom and advice you've shared with your grandchildren? Have you interviewed an elder about their life, StoryCorps style? What did you learn from them? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. The book is called Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life, and Charles Johnson stays with us. Charles, we were hearing earlier before the news break from Chris, who was referring to Emerson and dream delivers us to dream and there is no end to illusion. What would you say to Chris?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I was listening very carefully to everything Chris said, because it was wonderful. The things that she brought out, Emerson is one of my favorite authors, and I think he's one of the great American minds of the 19th century. And he does emphasize that sense of wonder that we should have about our experience every day. And we should see every day of our life, especially now with the, you know, coronavirus, as a gift. Every day as a gift. Now, something else I picked up listening to Chris was what an incredibly rich life Chris has led. You know, as an educator, all the things that Chris has done, this experience should not be lost. You know, it's wonderful that she has, Chris has grandchildren, because they will benefit from Chris's experience. In other words, I think we really should, in our culture, respect elders for the lives that they have led. Now, something else Chris said I thought that was very important is the amount of information, you know, that we give our kids, our young people. It's incredibly huge what they have to absorb. But I think one of the things that's important to realize is that for our students, and I was a teacher for 33 years, and for our grandchildren, is we don't want to tell them what to think. We want to just simply teach them how to think, and they will come to their own conclusions.
You were your grandson's age when the civil rights movement was unfolding. What do you remember from that time, and what are you trying to share with him?
That's very interesting. I have a chapter on Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement because in 1998 I published a novel called Dreamer, which is about the last 2 years of King's life. In 1966, he brought the Freedom Campaign to Chicago, and I was 18 years old. I was a high school student. I remember I graduated that June in 66, and he came earlier in January. It was his first and only northern campaign, and it wasn't terribly successful in terms of his goals because he was outmaneuvered, I think, by Mayor Richard Daley. But nobody had ever written about that. So my novel covers, you know, that period right up to his death. I also did another book called The Photobiography of Martin Luther King Jr. I did that book. I wrote the text for it. It's really a book of photographs. And many of them were taken by the late civil rights photographer Bob Adelman. He was the official photographer for CORE and SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But the book is full of other people's photographs, too. Some of those photographs are iconic. You know, the one where King is giving a speech during March on Washington, and we're looking up at him, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's Bob's photograph. He was right kneeling below King at that time. The other photograph that's so iconic that Adelman took was in Birmingham. And we've all seen this photograph of a police dog pulling at the trouser leg of a black man, right, tearing it. Bob took that photograph. He was there as well. I spent about 7 years of my life researching Dr. King and writing about him and giving talks about him, you know, on his birthday. I guess the reason why is I felt I didn't really know him. You know, in the 1980s, I started thinking back. I said, well, you know, didn't King have a lot to say to us other than about demonstrations? And he did. He had lots of life lessons in his sermons, you know, and in his speeches. A lot of the problems that we're addressing today, he talked about back in the 50s, you know, the late 50s and the early 60s. So I have a chapter called The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. That's one of his favorite speeches. If I'm not mistaken, he gave that speech in Montgomery when he got his first job. And then when he was going to pick up a Nobel Peace Prize, he stopped in England and gave it there. The three dimensions of a complete life. And I can summarize what those dimensions are for you. The first dimension is respect for yourself. Find out what it is, and King was a minister, so he put it in these terms. Find out what it is that God wants you to do, you know. Find out what your calling is, and whatever it is, do it so that the living, the dead, and the unborn couldn't do it better. That's a quote from King. The second dimension is we don't live alone in our world. You know, we are dependent on others from the time we get up. You know, we go down and make our coffee, you know, and it comes from South America. And everywhere that we turn and look, we find the presence of others globally, you know, in our lives. So we have to be respectful of our our we relation with everybody else on the planet. And the third dimension, of course, for King, because he was a minister, is God, because he says, we will be restless until we rest in God. Those are the three dimensions. Now, I would say it is good. It is important to have some spiritual practice in your life. I think that gives you a perspective that's very important in a culture that is very, very, very materialistic. You know, we're exposed to over 3,000 product messages every day.
What would King say about the protests now around the country?
I think he would be pleased. One of his final speeches, you know, this is towards the end of his life, and the title of one of his final sermons or speeches is Unfulfilled Dreams. And what he says in that sermon is, what we're trying to do is finish the unfinishable. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, finish the unfinishable. Now, after his death, Coretta, his wife, was interviewed. And she was asked the question, what would you tell young people? And Coretta said, well, we told them a lot and we did a lot, but one thing we didn't tell young people is that the fight that we had for equality and civil rights is not over. They would have to fight the same fight again. And that's what you're seeing right now, in my opinion, is that things that were not resolved during the civil rights movement, right, which goes from about 1955 to 65, you know, we get the Voting Rights Act and you know, the Civil Rights Act and so forth, 64 and 65. These are perennial, well, not perennial, but recurring problems in our society. So it's a younger generation that has to address them. My daughter's 38. She's an artist, a conceptual artist and a poet. And I was talking to her yesterday, and she's been taking supplies and snacks to people protesting here in Seattle on Capitol Hill.
We're talking with Charles Johnson, an author, a scholar, philosopher, grandfather. His new book is called Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life. And you can join in with your perspective on what a grandparent has told you. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Charles, you talk about the gatekeepers, the Muslim wisdom of the three gatekeeper questions. Mm-hmm. What are some of those? What are those three questions that we should bear in mind?
I think this is kind of universal wisdom. You find it in Rumi, the poet, right? And but I've seen it in other places as well. I've seen it in Hindu culture. I've seen it in Muslim culture. It has its place also in Christian culture. The three gates are this, are questions. Before we speak, we should pause and think about what it is we're going to say before we let it out in the world. We should check what we're going to say at three gates. The first gate is the question, is it true? The second gate is it necessary? By which I mean, or it means, is it necessary to say at this time? Is this the appropriate time, you know, to say it? And the third gate is, will it do no harm? Those three questions. If what you're about to say can pass those three gates, then I think it can be released into the world and will not do any harm and will do good because it's true.
Do you think about those gates in your life as you speak to your grandson?
Oh, all the time. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm a practicing Buddhist, and one of the things in the Eightfold Path that we try to follow is right speech. Right speech is kind speech, mindful speech. It's thoughtful speech. It is not angry speech. You know, that's just one of my practices. And it's not just my grandson that I speak that way with. I try to practice that with everyone. Yeah, absolutely.
Novelist and philosopher Charles Johnson stays with us. His new book is Grand, where he distills life lessons for the next generation. Still time to talk about lessons passed down to you at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with author Charles Johnson right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We have author and philosopher Charles Johnson with us. His new book is called Grand. It's a collection of his life stories and the perennial truths passed to his grandson, Emery. He wishes to warn Emery of all the dangers, but he writes, "One problem is that grandfatherly advice is as plentiful as blackberries." Have you dispensed advice to your grandchild? Are you caring for them now? What are your conversations like? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Gary now, who is joining us from Boscobel this morning. Hi, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't know if I can fit my comment in so that it overlaps smoothly with the author, but I've been enjoying the conversation and the idea of older people sharing the wisdom and knowledge that we've gained over a lifetime of paying attention and having compassion and having concern for future generations. Usually that is acknowledged and glorified by people reaching out with, in times of disaster or helping, save starving children around the world or other intensely humanitarian efforts, which are in our DNA to reach out like that. But one of the things that has always bothered me is I spent 45 years of my life doing environmental restoration as a volunteer, protecting endangered species, helping purchase land to preserve our biological diversity on the planet. And there's probably hundreds of thousands of people across the country that commit their lives to protecting our environment, our water, our air, our biodiversity on the planet. And without these people protecting this stuff, the future would look extremely bleak as our environment and our life support system crumbles away around us. And so those people that work in that field really get very little recognition for what they're contributing. But we continue to do that because we believe without question that our efforts are critical to future generations.
Yeah.
And it's typical of humanity to look in front of us instead of way down the road at what we really are going to need in the long term. So I don't know if that fits in with the philosophy, but it struck me that way.
Yeah, Gary, thank you for bringing that. Charles, what would you add there?
Well, there's very little I can add. I mean, I'm extremely impressed. 45 years working on environmental restoration and reminding us of the importance of biodiversity. This is exactly right. I'm a practicing Buddhist, so I'm concerned with all sentient beings, not just humans, but all of the species that we have, many of which are disappearing as we endure climate change and some of the damage that we've done to the planet. This is something that shouldn't be lost as a thought, and it's not lost. I mean, I teach. I'm retired now at the University of Washington. I'm an emeritus professor, but a great deal of the work that's done in the sciences at UW is devoted to just the things that Gary has pointed out.
When you look at our world and the pursuit of bringing the sciences together with the humanities, how can you bring that down to a level that we can bring in our own lives each day, that we can carry out?
Oh, this is very important. One of the things that I do with my daughter is a series of children's books called The Adventures of Emery Jones, boy science wonder. We've done three so far. The first book involves young Emory Jones. He's named after my grandson, okay? The first book is called Bending Time. The second book is called The Hard Problem. And about a year ago, my daughter and I, we finished the third book, which is called The Tomorrow No One Wanted. And that book, the third one, is actually about climate change. So one of the things we try to do for a young adult audience, right, middle school, high school, going into high school, is give the kids an adventurous story. An adventure story, one that has, you know, a kind of science fiction plot, but which also teaches the importance of the sciences. We want to get young people, you know, in the Emory Jones series, interested in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, right? But we also want it to be STEAM. We put the A in, so we get the arts in there. So Emory is a kind of super scientific young black boy, and he has a friend, his dearest friend, is named Gabby, and she wears a hearing aid, but she's a poet. So we get steam through, you know, both of those two characters, and for me they're a delight to write, because again, it's kind of from the viewpoint of a younger person,
yeah,
who hasn't sort of been spoiled, you know, and it becomes cynical and jaded, right, about the world. I think what Gary pointed out is extremely important, and so are the sciences.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Kate, thank you for having me on. This has been a pleasure.
Charles Johnson's new book is called Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for a Happy Life. And if you missed any part of the conversation, you can stream it later this morning and share it. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. The nationwide wave of protests against police brutality and racial injustice has reached into Wisconsin's small cities and towns. Many people who've never protested before are getting involved, and rural areas are seeing unprecedented participation. Rob Mentzer has more.
Say his name!
George Floyd!
Black lives
matter!
Black lives matter!
On Saturday, some 1,500 people marched in Wausau in protest. The gathering there looked a lot like marches and protests across the country in the weeks since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. But it was the largest political demonstration Wausau has seen in decades, maybe ever.
It's thrilling, but I mean, this has been everywhere.
Carmen Hohen is one of the organizers of the Wausau event. She says the movement has reached even smaller cities.
There have been protests, rallies in all 50 states, which is huge, and even across the world. Like, you see even, like, small towns that you wouldn't think would have protests, with, like, Annago, Rhinelander, everyone's coming together.
All right, you guys, how are you doing today?
About 40,000 people live in Wausau. Its march on Saturday was among the largest the state has seen outside of Madison and Milwaukee. It's a sign of how broad and far-reaching the protest movement has become. For people of color like Hohen and another organizer, Gwen Taylor, the event was also a way to assert their right to belong.
Being part of a minority community, you don't always feel the numbers in small communities. I think it's even more important, if not just as important, for the small communities to come out together, for people to feel welcomed and come out of the woodwork and see that our community is diverse, and we have strength in that diversity.
In the last week alone, there have been protests across Wisconsin's rural landscape. Hundreds marched in Sturgeon Bay and in Shawnee. On Saturday, about 60 people gathered in Hayward, population 2,300. On Wednesday, northern Wisconsin protesters walked across the bridge from Marinette to Menominee, Michigan. For lots of participants, it's their first time at a protest. Caitlin Schultz joined her first protest in Wausau at the end of May. She's been to three more in central Wisconsin since then. She has time to protest because she lost her job amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But she's also been moved by the experience.
I'm kind of an emotional person, so I tend to tear up and I might cry a little bit, and I get goosebumps when people are honking and stuff. And I just, you feel good. You feel like you're doing something important.
In Superior on Thursday, 21-year-old Clivia Prince said she does worry about her safety and the safety of her younger brother as black people in a mostly white city. But she says seeing community support for the protests has helped her.
Seeing a lot of not people of color supporting us and seeing that they do care about our lives and they do care that were people too.
For the most part, small cities have not seen the vandalism or violent clashes between police and protesters that have marked some large city protests. Ephraim Nikwai is a member of Superior's Police and Fire Commission. He says he hopes small cities can be a model for how to bring people together.
And when you look at the protest today, we see how peaceful it is. We see how engaged people were. You see all the honking of cars, and just to show that the community really supports it. And this is an example that we could share with other communities.
You guys, let's have a great, peaceful protest.
In Wausau, organizers worked with police to put on Saturday's event. They say the march is the beginning of a movement that's still growing. Wausau organizer Kaylee McCauley says she's as surprised as anyone at how widespread the protest movement has become in just weeks.
I feel a joy and a hope that if you would have asked me a week and a half ago, I could not truly say that I felt.
In a speech, McCauley told attendees that she was shocked in the best of ways to see more than 1,000 people marching with her. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.